So my talk today addresses masculinity and incarceration among a population of bisexually active, but not necessarily identified, African-American men here in the Bay Area. I want to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Cynthia Gomez, who's sitting back there at this lovely large conference table. Mass incarceration is a racial justice, sexual rights, and HIV prevention issue. HIV and incarceration, as I'm sure you all know, disproportionately affect African-American men, and the political economy of black sexuality is intimately linked to the criminal justice system. 1 in 3 young African-American men is either currently incarcerated or under direct control of the criminal justice system. Recent epidemiological findings conclude that structural factors such as incarceration, not individual behavior factors, are the primary drivers of the vast racial and ethnic inequalities in the epidemic overall and also among men who have sex with men, including bisexually active men. My talk today presents stories of same-sex desire, practice, and identity through my research with 49 formerly incarcerated HIV-negative and HIV-positive bisexually active black men here in the Bay Area in Oakland and San Francisco. So just a brief overview of my talk today. I'll give, again, a brief background on HIV and incarceration. I'll present a theoretical framework of prisonization. I'll go through the study and methods, and then I'll address some of the main findings related to gender, sexuality, and incarceration. And I'll conclude with some thoughts about what I'm calling gendered prisonization and its relationship to HIV prevention. And in particular, throughout the talk, I address the ways in which masculinities or the beliefs, social practices, and institutional norms regarding what it is to be a man are produced and negotiated through systems of mass incarceration. So the roots of HIV disparities lie in social and economic environments. And as I just mentioned, increasingly public health and epidemiological research is finding that risk behaviors do not explain the vast disparities in HIV, but rather structural barriers such as higher levels of incarceration, poverty, unemployment, barriers to care, and lower levels of educational attainment. As Greg Millett and colleagues put it in their article in the Lancet special issue this summer, and I quote, HIV is inextricably linked to social and economic environments that should be considered and must be addressed to successfully stem disparities in HIV infection. So structural factors affect the availability and choice of sex partners, keeping people isolated in neighborhoods and sexual networks with higher HIV prevalence, higher community viral load, raising infection risks. So just a brief context about the global prison context here. As we see, the United States, as you may know, is home to about 4.5% of the world's population. It's also home to almost one quarter, just under 23% of the world's prison population, followed closely by China, as you see there. And further, when we look closely at the epidemic within the United States, we see that the young, the male, the black, and the Latino are disproportionately incarcerated. The U.S. Bureau of Justice estimates that there are over 846,000 African-American men in prison, making up 40% of all inmates in the country. African-Americans have faced a doubling of incarceration rates since the mid-1980s, when the so-called war on drugs disproportionately targeted poor communities of color and placed men of color behind bars, barring men from full citizenship for petty theft and small possession charges, primarily. This has created a situation in which 1 in 15 black men is currently incarcerated, and 1 in 9 young black men between the ages of 20 and 34 is currently incarcerated. And this compares to 1 in every 100 U.S. adults overall. And as a point of historical comparison, legal scholar Michelle Alexander points out that more African-American adults are under correctional control today, and by that I mean in prison, jail, or on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. So now I move to prisonization. Sociological work has drawn on the framework of prisonization to examine the social experiences of incarcerated communities. So a lot of work on HIV and incarceration focuses on HIV risk in the context of incarceration, trying to determine, for example, if risky sex is happening, and if so, what are the routes of transmission. Prisonization allows us to focus on much more richly on experiences of incarcerated individuals. And the concept of prisonization was introduced in 1940 by sociologist Donald Clemmer, and describes the socialization to prison conventions, practices, and culture on the part of the inmates. So prisonization begins when a prisoner enters the prison system and captures the effects of the punishments, deprivations, and complex carceral norms on the daily life of the individual. And so some components of prisonization include forced adoption of prison rules and regulations, incorporating new practices of daily life, such as eating and sleeping, and adopting prison language or languages. While regulatory practices and the punishments of prison strip inmates of their humanity, autonomy, and freedom as individuals, inmates nonetheless come up with their own inmate codes or informal sets of rules that define normative boundaries and social hierarchies for acceptable behavior and expression. So given the high rates of both incarceration and HIV among African-American men, I feel that prisonization provides a useful framework to examine experiences of sexuality in carceral settings. So the study that we conducted was called the Maasai Project, and it was a qualitative research project here in the Bay Area in Oakland and San Francisco from 2009 to 2011. We did one-time qualitative interviews with 60 bisexually active but not necessarily identified black men who were HIV negative and positive. Men were recruited through ethnographic mapping and also targeted outreach. And inclusion criteria were based on self-reported sexual activity with both men and women. And we also added an exclusion criteria of self-identification as gay. So the interviews asked about sexual practices, identity, incarceration, and HIV risk. And about 49 men, or 82% of our sample, described their experiences with incarceration. And these range from short, sort of one-time short experiences in prison, for example, to some of our participants who had spent much of their lives behind bars. And men discussed ongoing cycles of incarceration related to minor offenses and parole violations. In the short time remaining, I want to take as my point of departure that issues of power and social control are embedded in research on incarceration as they are in the topic in question. Mass incarceration is a literal social and sexual space that strips men and women of rights, humanity, and sexual freedom. And research on incarceration is informed by the power dynamics inherent in this context. As I mentioned before, while much of the research on HIV and incarceration seeks to identify the HIV risk behaviors that are happening in carceral settings, this study offers a unique perspective because it was conducted with men who had already either identified as having a bisexual identity or identified as being bisexually active. So our analysis then was able to focus much more richly on questions of sexual identity and practice. So men described at length their experiences of incarceration, sex, and sexuality in these interviews. And what was really striking about these interviews was the centrality of gender, and in particular masculinity, as a site through which prisonization or socialization into prison culture took place. Men described gendered codes, practices, and strategies that they negotiated through sexual practices amidst the complex social and sexual hierarchies inside. The overall experience of being stripped of agency and rights while incarcerated was described in very clearly gendered terms. To be incarcerated, one is necessarily not a man, in the words of one HIV-negative man from Oakland. And I read, "In prison, you're not a man. I'm going to always be a man, but you know you're not fully a man because you're being instructed to do this or told how it is by another individual who calls the shots like you a little kid now. And there's nothing you can do about it because you put yourself in that predicament. And if they say, hey, you go in that cell and lock up, you got to do it. You can only piss now. That's what you're going to eat or don't eat. So that takes away from your manhood because you're being told how to live. So that just really degrades you and you feel like a real punk, man, a straight sucker. And that's how I'm feeling, like, wow, I'm a real man. I ain't with this shit." So this man describes being infantilized and punished through being deprived of his personhood and masculinity. There is no question in his mind as to the pervasive authority of the prison system and its reach into all basic functions of his body. And yet, as he describes, he is a man, and more so, a real man. Being incarcerated and being stripped of his agency in ways that undermine his masculinity serves to reinforce the gendered dimensions of the inmate role that he assumes as he seeks to survive, let alone resist, the state. In this regard, power, survival, and resistance, in essence, speak the same language. Inmate codes are informed by cultural norms from inmates' outside life and are often based on cultural ideals of masculinity that punish weakness and promote being men in the institutional context of being stripped of one's very personhood. So alongside the necessity of being a man, men, and in particular those who were self-described queens, divas, or gays on the inside, and these were men who did not necessarily identify as gay on the outside, described the social necessity of having a man for social protection and status. Men described sexual relationships in the context of gender roles in order to survive. As one man put it, and I quote, "You have all these different classes, all these different structures where you have to fit into one specific category." And he continues, "Even though I was never a darling diva, I was always a gangsta gay boy, you know. But you still had to have a man. I've always been the bottom. I was the one who did the socks. I did the laundry. One time this guy moved into my cell and he wouldn't have sex with me and I was going to put him out. He said, well, I took an HIV test and I'm not sure. I could very well be positive. And you know what? For that moment, I didn't care. I was just so worried about having a man, you know, having sex, and then it turned out that he was HIV positive." And he reflects a lot in the interview on this. It's sort of a moment of reflection on what had happened at that time. And for this HIV negative participant, having sex with a man who he knew might be HIV positive was not essentially a consideration alongside his need, as he says here, to have a man. Clicking up, being protected with a backup, not being weak prey by oneself, all of these social arrangements are informed by norms of masculinity. And if one does not cohere to masculine ideologies, body type, or practices, having a man can, in essence, perform a certain masculinity. Inmate codes of manhood are informally regulated such that those who violate them can face punishment on the part of other inmates. And this participant described a first year of hazing rituals, forced sex, being robbed, intense relationships with men, many of which were deeply intimate, and finally the place where he came to fit in and find a place, which was over daily pinochle in the afternoon with the older guys, one of whom became his protector. And he did a year at that time, and he vividly describes in the interview looking over the yard the night before being released on parole, thinking with a sense of accomplishment, "I made it. I made it. I did this." While most men described a spectrum and often simultaneous experiences of consensual to coercive sexual relationships inside, we also heard from some men who described not wanting to or not having sex inside because they were not willing to risk their reputation as heterosexual on the street. And this participant says, "I have, like, I guess you could say, like a code or whatever. You don't want people to know that you're doing certain things, so you have an image to project. And in all actuality, I did get down with guys. I just wasn't getting down in prison. I've never got down in prison. I feel for my safety, more importantly, that they try to harm me and I would lose my social status. I'm going to call it like it is. In prison, I would be considered an outcast, and I don't want to lose that status that I've got built up." He had a very active street life, and he was very covert, let's say, about his sexual relationships with men. So, like him, other men who talked about this were often the most covert about their sex with men on the outside, and there was a lot at stake for them if they were to be, quote-unquote, discovered. Who one is, of course, is far more than what one does. As one interviewee said, you have to pretend to be someone who you're really not just for survival. And getting out, returning back to one's communities, while liberating men from the correctional institution, was far from liberating in all senses of the word. As this participant put it, quote, "Once you get out, you're back to playing a role." So men in this study describe negotiating gendered norms and roles as they adopted their inmate roles in the context of the social hierarchy inside. And these findings point us to a framework of what I call gendered prisonization, which offers an intersectional understanding of how men negotiate gendered and racialized sexual and social systems in carceral settings. Gender, and in particular masculinity, became a site through which prisonization or socialization into prison culture took place, through either the insistence of being a man or the potentially life-saving necessity of having a man. Importantly, while stories abound about the ubiquitousness of inmate sex, and were certainly corroborated by many of these participants' experiences, these interviews also provide insight into the varied experiences of sexual practices and the many gendered bodily practices men use to conceal or express sexual desire for men. These stories are forms of structural intimacies, which is a concept that I take up in my book, Structural Intimacies, Sexual Stories in the Black AIDS Epidemic, just for a shameless moment of self-promotion. It'll be coming out next spring. And structural intimacies are sexual stories produced by the meeting of intimate lives and social structural patterns. Understanding the gendered context of incarceration for men's sexual practices and identities is, I believe, critical for advancing HIV prevention efforts that focus on the structural drivers of the epidemic, as well as for deepening our understandings of the complexities of gender and sexuality in carceral settings and beyond. And I want to thank the many amazing research participants who we worked with, our project staff, field sites, and our funder. Thank you.